In particular, today's critical questions have to do with what one might call the question or the problem of representation. Okay, so that's going to be the key theme in today's lecture, the main problem. In Spivak's work, of course, the question of representation is always double-edged. She uses it and means it in two interrelated but different ways. One is to represent, as in the work of imagination that represents reality, say in literature or in art. Okay, so the ways in which we use and think of representation as students of literature, that is one aspect of the question of representation. The other aspect that Spivak works on throughout her critical writings is the idea of representation as in to stand in for, to speak for, to speak as in the realm of politics. Okay, so her work and our discussion today will draw on these two different but interconnected definitions or understandings of representation: to represent reality or matter or an idea, and to represent as in to stand in for, to speak as. Okay, so the bringing together of the realms of literature and politics as central to the question and the problem of representation. But before I go into a detailed analysis of Spivak's contributions to literary and cultural theory, a few words about Gayatri Spivak herself to put things in some context. The anthology does give a brief biography of her, so I will not repeat the details, but just highlight some very interesting aspects about Spivak as a literary critic. Gayatri Spivak was born in India. She graduated from Calcutta University and went on to receive a PhD in comparative literature from Cornell University in the United States. She has been part of the American academic world since the early 1960s. She's currently a professor at Columbia University in New York. Spivak became a star on the academic conference and lecture circuits in the 1980s, which was a decade of intense campus mobilization in the United States and in Britain as well on the question of identity. Identity politics were really important in the 1980s. And it was the decade in which many of the disciplines and subjects we now take as given, such as African American studies, Asian American studies, Latino-Latina studies, gay and lesbian studies, gender and sexuality studies and departments, were established and consolidated. Spivak's own positioning as an Indian intellectual in the Western Academy, one who was fully at home, and in fact one who had mastered its dominant codes, made her a much desired and quite a spectacular public figure. And in fact, you can actually look, search for her, some of her talks in YouTube. She makes quite an interesting figure, and I'll say a bit more about that. Even as many criticized her for exploiting her position and encouraging the cult of her personality, for indulging in self-exoticization. And you see this in the interviews that you've read as well. She would famously appear at lectures and conferences wearing, you know, resplendent silk saris, high heel leather boots, short cropped hair that she would have dyed red, totally participating, in the decade in which identity was being hailed as deeply political and as performative. And it is in this context that Gayatri Spivak became a huge star in sort of the Western Academy and within literary and cultural studies. On a more serious note, Spivak has been a key and quite controversial figure within post-colonial literary studies and theory, the study of literatures and theories coming out of national contexts from the middle of the 20th century after those nations achieved independence from colonial rule. And Spivak is considered to be one of the leading figures in terms of writing and thinking about that literature and those cultures. Her extremely abstract, high theoretical language and style that expresses a virtuosic familiarity with high European theory is seen to be at odds with her Marxist feminism and her purported project of speaking for the subaltern, the underprivileged, the marginalized. So that's another thing I want you to note, not just in the language of the interviews, but also actually to note the various linguistic and theoretical registers of the various critical pieces that you read in the anthology, right? So different critics have very different voices and different ways of theorizing. It is perhaps fitting then, although curious nevertheless, that the anthology for this module, the anthology we are using, has two interviews with Spivak rather than essays from her. The genre of the interview, of course, I think is a great one for Spivak because it allows her to stage herself, to present herself, and she's very much about the politics of presentation, of self-presentation as an intellectual, even though she seems, at places, I think she slips and she seems surprisingly unself-conscious of that happening. And in other places in the interview, she seems to exploit it. She seems to build on the fact that, you know, her interviewees don't quite always get her, okay? So I want you to think about the interview as a genre and the ways in which it becomes a vehicle for Spivak to expand on and extend her theories, okay? I will now address some of the key critical themes that the interviews touch upon. And of course, I'm also drawing from a wider reading of Spivak's work, but hopefully, you know, it may spark some interest in some of you to pursue this further. And these are themes that, of course, we will find useful in the module more generally. The first topic I want to consider is what the first interview begins with, and that is the issue of authenticity and identity. Authenticity and identity. And this, of course, we can all see is quite clearly linked to the question and the problem of representation. Okay? In many ways, as I spoke last week, this is also a key critical problem in the Buddha of Suburbia, right? The question of identity. What makes an authentic identity? Is it possible to have an authentic identity, or is identity always about a certain kind of performance, a certain kind of self-presentation, self-representation? As Spivak points out, any one of us inhabits many subject positions. All of us, every one of us in this room, for instance, you know, has a particular race assignation, gender, class, we belong to particular localities, you know, we affiliate with particular sexualities, etc., etc., right? So that can be taken as a given, the idea of multiple subject positions, of multiple identities that we all have. The problem in the Buddha of Suburbia and the problem for Spivak, as she expresses it in the interviews, is that the question of identity becomes a specially vexed one for minorities in a dominant culture. Okay, and that is, of course, the theme of the Buddha of Suburbia. As Spivak argues in the interviews, that the dominant culture begins to treat people, especially from minority communities, as representatives, as tokens, okay? And we see this so well illustrated in the Buddha of Suburbia in, for instance, the desire of characters such as Eva to read Karim's father as representing Indian culture. Now, of course, this desire is satirized in the novel. It's so ironic because, of course, Karim's father is an Indian Muslim who is staging his identity by taking on Eastern mysticism that is derived from Hindu and Buddhist traditions, right? So it's a total mix of various traditions, various cultures, and yet he becomes a representative of, you know, a supposedly authentic Indian culture. It is also the struggle of Karim to be simultaneously Indian and English. He wants to be an actor as someone with a still undefined sexuality. The point is that, and I think it's made in the novel quite vividly, is that while the racist or fascist, you know, the ones who shout those slogans and burn the homes of blacks and Asians, while they want to obliterate, to erase all traces of the other, even as they need the other to maintain their own identity, the liberal desire, right, of people like Eva and other, you know, upper class liberal British people, the liberal desire to hear, to listen to the other, has its own dangers in the ways in which it can often lead to a demand for authentic voices, right? So liberalism, in a way, constructs this desire for authenticity, right? The desire to find the authentic native. This, Spivak suggests, is, and I think Qureshi suggests as well. And for Qureshi, of course, you know, we have the novel, but he also has, you know, given so many interviews, and he has many essays that you can turn to where he writes about these issues. That this is both the political challenge and the pitfall of multiculturalism, as we know it in Britain today, in which certain people are made to speak for all immigrants. Okay, and I think that this is a particular problem for women, okay, and for questions of gender in immigrant communities, because that question often gets elided as male representatives come to stand in for, right, the political use of representation, come to represent the community, okay? And of course, multiculturalism simultaneously constructs minority communities as stereotypically traditional and religious and conservative, right? Which is why people have a problem thinking of Karim as an authentic subject, because he doesn't really seem to fit the box we often want minority figures to fit into, you know? So if they are legible and understandable if they are religious and conservative and traditional, but not if, like Jamila and Karim, they are young and vibrant and, you know, they derive their sense of identity from both Indian culture but also from, you know, world culture, right? From blues and jazz and African-American civil rights struggles, etc., etc. Okay? This is very much the predicament of Jamila, right, who, as the voice of a young woman, gets subjected to domination both within her community, and here Spivak doesn't want to let off minority communities either, right? She points to the ways in which the diasporic culture is also complicit in gender exploitation, right? So while the dominant culture ignores women, treats men as representatives of the community, diasporic culture similarly indulges in a nostalgic longing backwards, right, towards customs, religion, tradition, as a way to carry on, to preserve culture, you know, in Britain. Okay, so the figure of the woman, in a way, gets doubly victimized or doubly elided, both from dominant British society, but also from within the minority diasporic society. Okay, now this aspect of multiculturalism that constructs an authentic migrant, right? And the fact that Karim is, you know, is struggles to be one, is never one, has an older colonial history in the figure of the native informant, the one who translates native culture for consumption and knowledge production in the West, right? So we tend to look at spokespersons, right, who will tell us about their culture, right, about the East, about the Orient. Of course, we'll talk more about this next week when we discuss Edward Said. But nevertheless, I want us to note that knowledge about the other, knowledge about the East, is thus deeply tainted because also of this long history of colonialism, racism, etc. Okay? Now, another pitfall of the cult of authenticity or the politics of authenticity is the aspect of tokenism, right? That Spivak argues leads to ghettoization of minorities. As Spivak points out, this is also a kind of silencing. We can see this at play in the field of, I think, English literary studies, in which black and Asian writers are introduced in standard curricula to represent whole cultures and national literatures, right? I'm glad that in Modes of Reading we're taking a different approach. I don't think Qureshi is being presented, you know, as an Asian writer, right? We are interested in the critical problems, the critical issues raised by these literary texts. But this is often the way in which Asian and black writers get included in so-called mainstream English literary studies, right? So you can have a Qureshi or a Rushdie or a Toni Morrison, and they are supposed to represent their entire culture, right? They're supposed to stand in for India or black America, okay? For Spivak, then, and this is the second main theme I want to pick up from her interviews, and that is the question of investigating the one's own positionality, what she calls the historical critique of your position, okay, and by your, she means all of us, as investigating persons, our own location within the academy, right, as students of literature and of culture. And here, as you can see in the interviews, for Spivak, the site of the university is really important. It's really crucial. The classroom she sees as a space that can be a particularly politically charged space. And I want to just briefly read that quite interesting passage from page 597, which is a very typical Spivak staging of a scene in the classroom. Actually, I'll summarize bits of it. But she talks about Spivak is very much into her identity and self-presentation as a teacher, right? As a teacher in an American classroom. And she says, I will have in an undergraduate class, let's say, a young white male student, politically correct, who will say, quote, I'm only a bourgeois white male, I can't speak. In that situation, it's peculiar because I'm in the position of power and their teacher, and on the other hand, I'm not a bourgeois white male. I say to them, why not develop a certain degree of rage against the history that has written such an abject script for you that you are silenced? Okay? Then you begin to investigate what it is that silences you rather than take this very deterministic position. Since my skin color is this, since my sex is this, I cannot speak. Okay, and of course, she goes on and elaborates on this. To just briefly explain this scene, I mean, in a way, this is a very typical scene, I guess, from a Spivak classroom, where anything any student says is politically charged, right? And the students are being invited to not just comment on the topic under discussion, but to investigate their own subject positions, right? What is the position from which they are speaking? And of course, because Spivak teaches Mahashweta Devi, because she teaches third world texts, she presents this scenario of a middle class white male student saying, you know, almost sort of becoming paralyzed by this otherness, right, of the text, and saying, there's no way I can access this text. This is so other. There's a kind of sense of paralysis and fear and paranoia. And what Spivak says, that instead of this fear of the other that we sometimes may encounter in texts, what she's asking us to do is to look at the history of that fear, to look at the history of that difference. Why is it that some texts seem so alien, so different to us? Okay, and hopefully in your seminar groups you can use this opportunity to talk about your responses also to Mahashweta Devi's story and to Spivak's interviews. Okay, I now want to turn to the third theme from Spivak's interviews and from the readings in this section, in this part of Modes of Reading, and that is the question of the subaltern, which is drawn from a very famous essay by Spivak called Can the Subaltern Speak? This is an essay that's been widely anthologized. You can find it quite easily in a number of anthologies. But this is an essay in which Spivak sets out one of her sort of key contributions to the question of representation, which is the question of how do we represent the most marginalized, the most invisible, the most abjected, the poorest sections of society, right? And the term used is not class, it's not the poor, it's not working class, but subaltern, which is a term that a particular group of Indian historians drew from the work of the Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci, which refers to those sections of society who have no access to representation. Okay? Spivak's central thesis in this essay, and that she also touches upon in the interview, is that the reality of the lives and forms of consciousness, right, of the poorest masses of people cannot find adequate representation. This is a very complex sentence, so I'll repeat it a few times. Cannot find adequate representation in elite modes of conceptualization and textualization. This is sort of drawn, this is a sentence drawn from her essay, Can the Subaltern Speak? To state it more simply, Spivak is arguing that the consciousness of the subalterns, right, of those who have been completely left out, you know, from society, from representation, can never find adequate representation in elite modes of writing, right, whether we are writing literature or history, right? That literature and history as disciplines have a huge problem on their hands, okay, when they are writing about the subalterns, right? Those who actually cannot enter the realm of representation. In fact, she goes on to argue in a very controversial way in that essay, is that if somebody is able to be represented in a text, he or she is no longer a subaltern. Okay, because the subaltern is always unrepresentable, in a way is outside the text, and Spivak, you know, has been actually criticized for that. Okay, in particular, she has theorized what she calls the figure of the gendered subaltern. Okay, so the figure of the subaltern who is a woman. Okay, and she points out that even those projects, literary and historical projects, which have sought to represent the subaltern, even when they have attempted, those projects have failed because in a way those projects represent what she calls epistemic violence, right? So the very act of representing the subaltern woman ends up by obliterating her subjectivity. And in this essay, she gives the historical example of a practice in colonial India among a small group of natives, which involved the burning of widows on the funeral pyres of their husbands. In some parts of North India, this was a practice. Now, the British colonial rulers were completely mesmerized and shocked and appalled by this practice. And there are copious volumes of writing in the colonial archives about this practice, which was called sati, S-A-T-I. Okay? And so in this essay, Spivak does a critical reading of these archives to show that, you know, you have all the British officers describing this practice and being shocked by it and writing about how barbaric the Indians are, you know, to be involved in these, you know, savage practices in which women are burnt on their husband's funeral pyres. You also have writings by Indian elites, Indian reformers, right, who talk about how the British have no right to talk about these women. These women, you know, often went to the husband's funeral pyre of their own volition, their own agency. And what Spivak points out is that although there is so much writing about this gendered subaltern, this sati, right, what is completely absent is any indication of the woman's voice, of her agency, that there are no historical records. And there is no way to access what was the consciousness of this woman, this sati, right? Who was she being dragged, or did these women go voluntarily because they thought it was their religious duty to sacrifice themselves on their husband's funeral pyres? So she uses this historical example to get at the question of the difficulty, if not the impossibility, of representing the consciousness of the subaltern. Okay, she also, in her interviews, but also in her other writings, talks about the ways in which even current feminist discourses about the third world women, the third world woman, seem to elide and silence third world women, even as they are copiously represented, you know, in development writings, in literature, in various kinds of theories, right? What exactly is the agency and consciousness of third world women? That remains quite elusive in elite representations of women and the figure of the gendered subaltern, okay? I now want to turn to the story and say a bit about that. But before that, I want you to see a 6.5 minute clip, which is an interview with Mahashweta Devi, who is the writer of that story, but who's also an activist and who has been involved in working with tribals or the indigenous populations of India. Mahashweta Devi, in many ways, epitomizes the figure of the engaged intellectual. Her writings and her political activism come together in her stories, in her work. And Spivak has an interesting connection with Mahashweta Devi because Spivak has translated Mahashweta Devi's stories from Bengali into English. And has written a lot about Mahashweta Devi and, of course, about indigenous culture and indigenous people as subalterns. Okay, so let's just watch this. Should I turn off the mic for now? Or?
Yeah. Bhutanshagar of occupied village Purulia, it belonged to a denotified tribe. And denotified tribes all over India, they're very much oppressed, tortured, hounded by police. Bhutan was a fantastic handicraft man, very happily married, 3 kids. He was aged about 27-28. On 10th February 1998, Bhutan was just taken to the local police station. And the officer in charge, I'll refer to him as OC. OC Ashok Rai was a brute. He killed so many shavas, including women. What happened from 10th to 16th February, this OC kept Bhutan in that police station lockup, defended him on a dacoity charge, which was never proved, and beat him round the clock. Police had so many methods of beating, scars do not sew, wounds do not sew. They wrapped them with a blanket and beat them systematically. This is known as Kambal Dhulai. That night he was in crowd itself. He told another Shabar, Sudhar Shabar, that he has been beaten mercilessly. He doesn't think he will survive. What will happen to his wife and children, things like that. Next morning, Dhulai, he was absolutely in no position to move. He was asked by the jail warders to come out and sweep the big jail yard. Somehow he dragged himself there. Then he screamed, "They're killing me, please save me." They surrounded him and went and beat him on the head. So on the 18th morning, the telephone came. Bhutan is dead, police wants to kill him. They would have burned him. But somehow, some people got the news, they went there with Bhutan's wife and all, and after a big fight with police, brought the body back to his village. The women literally dragged his body and dug up Bhutan's own heart. They buried Bhutan and covered it with earth. Then Bhutan's wife slept on that. On behalf of Paschim Banga Sriya Shabar Salam Chamiti, I filed the public interest litigation case with Calcutta High Court on 23rd. Immediate order went to Purulia to exhume the body and second postmortem. In between, what the Shabars had done and the Samiti people together, since police was insisting on burning him, they made the with strong little dummy of Bhutan and burnt it. So police was convinced the body has been burned. Then police came, district magistrate came, body was exhumed, postmortem done, everything, the case started. And that day I sat on the floor and ate, because there are so many denotified tribes all over India. I have not thought about it. By July we got the judgment. The High Court ordered Ushkunda government to pay the wife 1 lakh rupees compensation and punishment and these things for other officers, things like that. But after filing the case, I had gone to Baroda. That night, me, Ganesh and Lakshman spent the night talking. Next day, we invited the press and announced the foundation of DNTified Hat. Our journal of DNT that started coming out, it was named Bhutan. This is Bhutan's story, which story is still continuing. Tribal mistrust about Diku, it dates that long. You must remember Ravani's economic period when they are entering the forest regions, the tribal regions for the first time. By Mahavad, it has got to be well organized. Moneylenders centered, British introduced land system, entered their lives. Why did Santal Rebellion take place? One fucking Bamu. Their Akbar wish would for once say 20, because they would lend them, say, five shares of in the in that time scenario, badly. He has to return 20 shares. So they come after harvest a big bull of earth loaded with cattle, which must be hundreds of shares. The moneylender come after, he takes all the and he says, it's not 20, it's 18, it's 19, it's never 20. So they say, Babu Akbar Vishnu just once uttered the word 20. So, Babu's never uttered the word 20. That's why somebody will be in this. Now you see how much you not have one handful of dust. No that problem. All these dams and industries in the tidal land is always, they are evicted from that.
That was just a short clip, but I wanted you to, of course, get a glimpse of Mahashweta Devi. And of course, here she tells the story both of a contemporary tribal, Budhan, who was beaten to death for being a tribal, and also the colonial history that, in a way, contributed to the marginalization of tribals through its land tenure system, which took away lands, you know, from the tribals into the hands of the landlords and those classes supporting the British. And as she points out, this is, of course, that system of snatching away the lands and forests and rivers from the tribals is continuing as India becomes a global economic power. Right, we hear in the media all the talk about India's huge economic miracle and success. And Mahashweta Devi's writings and works, she points out that this success is coming at the cost of India's poorest people, the landless peasants, the tribals, the subalterns. Okay, so it's a very, very mixed story that even after independence, the nation supposed to represent all its citizens actually leaves out, does not consider the plight of many millions of people living within the nation state. So the story Draupadi, with Devi, we turn to what could be considered protest fiction. She narrates the stories, not just here, but in almost all her writings, the stories of the most downcast sections of Indian society, the tribals. As the documentary points out, they are more than 10% of India's population. And along with the lower caste Dalits, they are among the most marginalized of people in post-colonial India. Of course, as the story points out, that there's a long history, as the documentary also says, of this racism, this marginalization, going back to the colonial period, in which the colonial state actually could never understand or come to terms with who the tribal was. They could understand who the Hindus were, and they classified the Hindus, etc. But the tribals, or the indigenous populations of India, they were never able to come to grips with them. They remained wholly other, wholly unassimilable. Simultaneously exotic and savage for the British in the colonial discourse. And that is also something that the story references. Another piece of background to keep in mind is that Draupadi, the story, has to be read in the context of a militant peasant movement that started in the late 1960s in North India, which was called the Naxalite movement. I'll spell it for you, N-A-X-A-L-I-T-E. It refers to the village of Naxal Bari in Bengal, in which this movement started. This was an armed insurrection led by peasants and tribals against landlords, moneylenders, police officers, in fact, against the Indian state, that it saw, the movement saw the state as complicit with the exploitation of the landless peasants and tribals. This movement found many sympathizers among India's elites, including students in India's big universities in the cities, intellectuals, writers, and journalists. So it's a very famous movement. You can look it up if you want to know more about it. That spread over many parts of India, and though it was a movement of tribal and landless peasants, it drew in people like Mahashweta Devi, okay, and lots of other elite urban young people and intellectuals into it. As you can expect, the movement was crushed brutally by the Indian state. States tend to be much more powerful than people's movements in the 1970s. And you can see the way in which the story enacts both the rebellion that Draupadi and her husband are part of, her husband is of course killed, and the brutality of the state machinery. In more recent years, in the last 4 or 5 years, in fact, there has been a massive resurgence of this movement, and it has spread to various parts of India, including, of course, Nepal. You might have heard of the Maoist insurgency in Nepal. So there's a long sort of geographical tract in South Asia, from Nepal all the way to southern India, in which this movement is gaining a lot of ground and has become one of the biggest issues in South Asia today. In short, the movement can be seen as a failure of Indian democracy to represent all Indians. And the failure of democracies, I think, in general, their failure to represent the poorest, the most marginal of citizens. The story Draupadi, of course, brings up the issue of resistance centrally. It represents the familiar story of state repression. Draupadi and her husband are two militants on the run. They're trying to escape the police. And of course, in the end of the story, she is caught and mercilessly raped and brutalized and tortured by the policemen who capture her. There are two things I want to say about the story. One is the title of the story itself. Draupadi is a central character in one of the big Indian epics called the Mahabharata, which was made into a famous play and film by Peter Brooks. You can see clips of this play, I think, on the internet. And Mahashweta Devi's story is an imaginative rendering of the story of Draupadi from the Mahabharata. And this is the story in Mahabharata. Draupadi was the wife of 5 brothers. You know, like Greek mythology, there are all kinds of interesting arrangements, you know, in Indian mythology as well. She's married to 5 brothers who are, at loggerheads with another kingdom. That neighboring kingdom also happened to be related to them. So there's trouble and strife between the kingdom of Draupadi's husbands and the neighboring kingdom that consists of 100 brothers. Okay, and as part of the strife and the competition between them, the neighboring kingdom invites Draupadi's husband to a game of dice as a way to solve their strife and the problems between the two kingdoms. Draupadi's husbands accept that offer and come and begin playing the game of dice. Now the evil neighboring kingdom have a figure who's able to manipulate the game. He teaches them how to cheat at the game, and Draupadi's husbands start losing, and they lose everything. They lose all their property. They finally lose their kingdom. Then the neighboring rulers say, well, you have to give up yourselves as slaves, and they agree to do that, and they continue playing and they still lose, and the neighboring kings say, well, what do you have to give now? You only have your wife Draupadi to give us. And so she, you know, we will take her and we will do as we want with her. The Draupadi's husbands feel that they have no other option and they give up Draupadi in that last stake. So there's a very dramatic scene in the epic in which Draupadi is brought into the center of the palace, and the neighboring, the head of the neighboring kingdom starts disrobing Draupadi, because of course to dishonor the wife, to dishonor the woman, would be the ultimate defeat, right, for Draupadi's husbands and her kingdom. And they start disrobing her to shame and dishonor her. But the trick is that Draupadi was a big devotee of Lord Krishna. And as they begin pulling her sari and they begin to disrobe her, she starts praying to Lord Krishna. And because of her devotion to Krishna, Krishna, does a miracle. And the more her sari is pulled, the more the length of the cloth increases. Okay, and so this is the drama, that they're trying to unravel her and shame her, but you know, her sari keeps increasing, it's endless, right? So they're unable to finally shame her, that ultimately Draupadi's devotion wins the day. So you can see how Mahashweta Devi is taking this story and rendering it in a very different context, because what you have here in this story is Draupadi's abjected body. Right, the last scene when she has been captured, when she's been raped, right? There's been a gang rape of her all night by various police officers and state functionaries, and she has been tortured. The way in which this completely abjected body, right? Think Draupadi of Mahabharat and then Draupadi of Mahashweta Devi's story, transforms into a resistant body. Right? So what we would consider to be, you know, the body of an abject victim, somebody who's been raped 100 times and tortured and brutalized, that body in itself becomes the site of resistance. The body speaks. Okay, if you look at the very last page of that story, as she stands, and even in that abjection, right, there are bruises all over her body. It's full of blood and bruises. The third paragraph from the end, Draupadi's black body comes even closer. Draupadi shakes with an indomitable laughter that Sena Nayak simply cannot understand. Okay, the idea of he cannot understand. Her ravaged lips bleed as she begins laughing. Draupadi wipes the blood on her palm and says in a voice that is as terrifying, sky-splitting, and sharp as her ululation, "What's the use of clothes? You can strip me, but can you clothe me again? Are you a man?" Right? So even in her shameful nakedness, right, she returns the gaze of her oppressor, right, who in that moment of utter hypocrisy, you know, when she's brought naked in front of the police chief, the Sena Nayak, he says, "Oh, I can't see her, you know, please clothe her. You know, I don't want a naked woman, you know, in front of me." And she sort of challenges him and says, she appears naked, willfully naked, defiantly naked. And in that particular scene, as in the scene from Mahabharat, you have the masculinized state, right? The masculine state represented by the police functionaries, it's the state that is exposed for its corruption and its shamefulness, right? Through, in returning the gaze, right, in making her body resistant, she actually changes the terms of shame and shamefulness, right? So the shame is not in her body. It is not her shame. It's the shame of those who have brutalized her. She looks around and chooses the front of Sena Nayak's white bush shirt. So the contrast between her blood-spattered body and his white clothes, to spit a bloody gob at, and says, "There isn't a man here that I should be ashamed." Okay, so the discourse of masculinity there, right? She's using a language that the state would understand, right, which is the power of being men, the power of masculinity, and turns it around. I will not let you put my cloth on me. What more can you do? Come on, counter me. Come on, counter me. Draupadi pushes Sena Naik with her two mangled breasts, and for the first time, Sena Naik is afraid to stand before an unarmed target, terribly afraid. And I think this is perhaps what Spivak might mean when she talks about the resistance of the subaltern and the difficulty of elite understandings, of elite consciousness, to understand and to represent this consciousness. I think the question is whether, you know, you think Mahashweta Devi succeeds in representing it. What are the ways in which the story represents subaltern consciousness, subaltern agency, and what do we make as readers of this text? Okay, so we'll stop here for today, and it'll be Edward Said next week.